Thank you, Andreas. Today, I will introduce the FASB's agenda consultation project, and then Rafael will introduce their third agenda consultation. We'll then turn it over to the boards for discussion of the questions we included in Agenda Reference 24. And additional materials for this discussion are included in Agenda References 24A through 24C. Last month, on June 24th, 2021, the FASB published an invitation to comment to solicit broad stakeholder feedback about the future standard setting agenda of the FASB as part of our agenda consultation project. The FASB issued a similar document in 2016, which resulted in many of the projects that we recently completed or have on our agenda today. The feedback on the ITC is essential in ensuring that the board continues to allocate its finite resources to achievable standard setting projects that fulfill its primary mission of improving financial accounting and reporting standards, as well as addressing topics that are of the highest priority to its stakeholders. The ITC doesn't include board views. Rather, the board will consider the feedback received in response to the document when making decisions about potential changes to its agenda. Those decisions include which topics, if any, should be added to the board's agenda and in what order, as well as whether the current agenda projects remain a priority to stakeholders or if they could be reimagined. To start this process, in the first half of 2021, staff and board members met virtually with over 200 stakeholders from its advisory groups and key stakeholder groups across all stakeholder backgrounds. Approximately one third of those we spoke with were investors and other financial statement users. During those outreach meetings, stakeholders identified over 40 topics of potential improvements for the board to consider as part of its standard setting efforts. This initial feedback was diverse, thoughtful, and insightful. The discussions included within the document are based on this input that we received from stakeholders. Their feedback generally fell within one of four categories, which I'll briefly summarize today. First, we heard feedback from investors that they require greater disaggregation and granularity of financial reporting information, either on the face of the financial statements or in the notes, to provide investors with better, more useful information that will directly influence their decisions and behaviors and help them better understand risks and future cash flows and operations. Their feedback ranged from greater disaggregation of line items on the income statement to additional granularity on the statement of cash flows, as well as more disclosure information, such as ESG-related items, income taxes, business combinations, et cetera. Second, we also heard feedback that certain emerging transactions need to be considered, such as in cases where there is no specific topical authoritative guidance or accounting or disclosure guidance, or in cases where the current accounting outcomes are not intuitive. And this is in order to reduce diversity in practice and to retain the relevancy of the codification. Third, we heard feedback that there are specific areas of existing gap that need to be reevaluated to reduce unnecessary cost and complexity. And lastly, we heard feedback about enhancements to and education on certain FASB standard setting processes to help increase transparency. Stakeholders have been asked to submit comments by September 22nd, 2021. The ITC includes both general questions about the future of the FASB's technical agenda, as well as directed questions on specific topics. As far as next steps, by the end of this year and the beginning of 2022, the board will look at all of this feedback and make changes to its agenda as necessary. I'll now turn it over to Rafael to introduce ISB's request for information.
Thank you, Erica, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. The International Accounting Standards Board published its request for information third agenda consultation on the 30th of March this year. The objective of this agenda consultation is to gather views on the strategic direction and balance of the board's activities, the criteria for assessing the priority of financial reporting issues that could be added to the work plan, and new financial reporting issues that could be given priority in the board's future work plan. Since publication, we have undertaken lots of outreach activities across many jurisdictions and have engaged with a broad range of stakeholders. Agenda paper 24C for this meeting sets out a summary of the initial feedback that the ISB has received on its request for information. The request for information is open for comments until the 27th of September this year. Therefore, the summary included in Agenda Paper 24C only reflects preliminary feedback and doesn't include all feedback that the board expects to receive on this agenda consultation. Regarding the first objective of the consultation, stakeholders generally agree that the strategic direction and balance of the ISB's activities is about right, but have provided suggestions to rebalance the level of focus on each activity. Most stakeholders we have spoken to say that we should continue prioritizing existing projects and undertake required post-implementation reviews of IFRS 9, 15, and 16 in a timely manner. However, some stakeholders have suggested that we reduce the level of focus on new research and standard-setting projects. Many of our stakeholders suggested the ISB focus more on maintenance and consistent application of the standards, digital financial reporting, and understandability and accessibility of the standards. There are mixed views as to what the future level of focus on the IFRS for SME standards should be. Stakeholders in jurisdictions that use the IFRS for SME standard would like us to do more in this area. Those that do not say that we can spend less time on this activity. There are also mixed views on the current level of focus on stakeholder engagement. Many stakeholders say the ISB's current activities are optimal to obtain views on its proposals from a broad range of stakeholders. But some stakeholders suggest the board focus even more on investors, for example, by providing more educational materials tailored to their needs. In the first part of the consultation, stakeholders also generally suggest the ISB consider setting aside capacity for interactions with its proposed sister board, the International Sustainability Standards Board. Consider setting aside capacity to respond to emerging issues, and consider partnering with national standard setters to help increase the board's capacity in some areas. In the second part of the consultation, we are seeking stakeholder feedback on the criteria that the board proposes to use to assess the priority of new financial reporting issues to add to its research and standard setting work plan. Most stakeholders say we have identified the right criteria. They say they would like to better understand how the criteria have been applied to individual projects and have commented on some practical issues and the practical use of the proposed criteria. The final objective of the agenda consultation focuses on the priority of new financial reporting issues that could be added to the ISB's research and standard setting work plan for 2022 to 2026. The request for information describes and estimates the size of 22 financial reporting issues that could be added to the ISB's work plan, and the staff observed several similar topics in both boards' consultations. From many of our stakeholders, we have been hearing consistent message that the board should be careful not to add too many new projects to the work plan because we will need capacity to deal with emerging issues and interaction with the proposed International Sustainability Standards Board. Almost all stakeholders have identified intangible assets as a high priority project. Some stakeholders suggest that the board develop better disclosure requirements about unrecognized intangibles. Others say a comprehensive review of the standard is needed. And other projects identified by many stakeholders as high priorities are cryptocurrencies and related transactions, climate-related risks, including accounting for pollutant pricing mechanisms, and the statement of cash flows and related matters. And with that introduction, I will now turn it over to the members of the boards for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Rika, and thank you, Rafael, for that. I open up the floor for any questions or comments. Nick, please.
Thanks, Andreas, and thanks to both of you for talking through your respective agenda consultations. One thing I learned early in my trade in equity markets was the mantra, cash is king. Follow the cash flows and you'll understand the economics of the businesses that you may be investing in. And I guess over the 30 years that I was involved in those markets, free cash flow became more of a focus for more and more investors. And I noticed from your invitation to comment that you've already had some calls to define free cash flow as a metric. I guess what concerns me is that increasingly we're seeing more and more transactions that are non-cash transactions but are economically equivalent to cash transactions. And we've just touched on some of those already. Supply chain financing would be one example. Inceptions of leases would be another. And certainly where debt is acquired through business combinations, probably not so frequent in domestic US markets, but certainly internationally would be a feature of those transactions, are all areas where you have transactions economically equivalent to cash flow, but bypass the cash flow statements. So really, I'm interested in a sense, perhaps from both staff and our colleagues at FASB, in terms of whether, and I see you also including the ITC mention of possible revisions of the cash flow statement, whether we need a wholesale review of that statement. And I'm not talking about direct or indirect, but can we really get back to that mantra? Can we actually say cash is king, that actually what appears in the cash flow statement does depict the economics of the business in their entirety? So just interested in views on that one. As Raphael mentioned, it's a topic that's already been moving to the top of the list of priorities from our early engagement on the agenda consultation. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Any views from board members at the FASB side or from the staff? Initial reactions? Rich, please.
Sure. Thanks, Andreas. And Nick, it is an interesting question. Part of the reason that we did a very, I'll call it open-ended invitation to comment, was to really try to flush out some of those issues, right? So we have heard from one group of constituents an interest in the statement of cash flows. And as you mentioned, direct cash flows, or for example, taking the indirect method and blowing it out more. But I think it's a valid question about is additional information needed and how would it be used? So our hope is to get some of that input through this process by casting as broad a net as possible. And I think you raised some very interesting points that I would be interested in feedback from.
Great. Thanks, Rich.
Okay, shall we go on to Christine, please?
Thank you, Andreas. And yes, Nick, that's a very thought-provoking question. So thank you for posing that question. My question has to do with seeking investor feedback on the agenda consultation. So I think that both boards suffer from the challenge of getting users to respond via comment letters. I was looking at the data that we both had with respect to various documents that we've issued related to goodwill, a project that is, you know, generally is quite a passionate responses are received. And yet, even on that, there was only, I think, two investors that responded for each of us in terms of a formal comment letter. So my question for Raphael is, how, you know, are you expecting to get most of your feedback from investors through the comment letter process, or are you planning on using other avenues to get investor input on the agenda consultation? And if you're planning on using other avenues, what do those avenues look like, and when in the process will you be conducting that that research? Thanks.
Thank you. So far we have met with some investors, and we have received very valuable feedback through virtual meetings and different types of virtual events with investors or investors organizations. And part of that feedback is already included in this initial feedback that is included in Agenda Paper 24C. So that's one of our ways that we can gather feedback. The other way is just keep reminding investors that we have consultation in progress, in underway, and that's their chance to share their views and priorities with us once every 5 years. So that's something we also do, keep reminding investors that the document is open for comments. And being mindful of their limited capacity to submit comment letters, we have at the very beginning prepared online survey, and the survey includes the same questions that we have in the RFI, and we expect to receive valuable feedback through that source of information. And we also try to remind stakeholders and promote the survey as much as possible, either directly or sending emails or other forms of communications, whether it be articles, webinars, interviews, or all these sorts of information that we are trying to reach people through. We haven't received any comment letters from investors yet. We have received some responses via online survey, but the document is still open for comments until the end of September. So we hope during the quieter period of August and September, we can receive some more feedback from investors. But I think we have, so far, we have received quite a good feedback from those investors that we have already met with, because they it's not very technical documents, so they are ready to share their feedback and they already know what their priorities are for the future. And we have, as I said, received a lot of information for that.
Okay, thank you for that question, Christine. Jinchao.
Thanks, and yes, also thanks, Luca, for your presentation about FSB's invitation to comment on your agenda consultation. My question is really about digital assets. I look at your invitation to comments, and digital assets is one of the emerging issues was identified by stakeholders and also was covered by your invitation to comments. I'm quite interested in the scope of the digital assets, because some people look at the digital assets very broadly, some look at the digital assets narrowly. So I wonder whether you have ever hearing so far from stakeholders about the scope of this potential project and what kind of assets those stakeholders would like to be addressed in your potential project. For example, whether the potential project should only focus on cryptocurrencies or should also include other type of digital assets broadly. So I'm really interested in listen to your views, particularly based on the feedback you have received so far from stakeholders. Thank you.
Sure. And to this point, we've only received 4 comment letters. So I'll provide some feedback with what feedback we've received during the development of the ITC. Stakeholders have acknowledged that there are challenges in identifying potential scope for this guidance. Some have suggested that the board could potentially provide short-term improvements by, for example, permitting a company to elect to apply a fair value option for certain digital assets if the fair value of those is readily determinable. So that's one scope that has been suggested to us. But in the ITC, we do specifically ask what types of digital assets should be included within potential scope. So we are asking for that feedback because at this point we haven't received specific feedback on that. So we are hoping to get that through this process.
Thank you.
Kim, you want to comment on this one?
Yeah, I think, Jinchao, that's one of the interesting challenges. If we were to take on a project, is exactly what the scope might be. There's a move in the U.S., at least by some, to have certain types of crypto or digital assets treated as commodities for regulatory purposes. So I think that would open up the question, if we were to take on a project, should it be, if they were in fact treated as commodities, would we have a project that addresses only digital assets as a commodity? Again, if that regulatory regime was set in place, or would we address all commodities? Certain digital assets, I think, already meet the definition of a security. So our literature would already treat those as securities. And so we have guidance that would require fair value. So I think scoping would be particularly interesting to get the feedback on, is what is it that entities are looking for in terms of us addressing a project.
Thanks, Jim. And if I just link that one up back to Nick's comment, Cassius King, if we are talking about cryptocurrencies, it seems that is cash-like rather than commodity-like or securities-like, but I don't want to go into that any deeper. I know that could be a pitfall. Let's hear from Rika then.
Sorry, Thank you, Andreas, and thank you for staff for our summary and presentation. And at level, already mentioned that I think based on the preliminary feedback and the initial feedback we have had, the intangible asset and related accounting and disclosures are kind of the high priority project for many stakeholders. So that is what we heard from our stakeholders. But when we asked them about the further detail about what their focus for us to do in the future as a potential project, their focus are kind of the mixed views on the whether they want us just focus on the enhancing the disclosures only, or some people consider we should revisit the requirement of measurement and the recognition of the intangible asset, and it might be necessary for us to consider the expand the scope of the intangible asset that can be recognized on the balance sheet. So I just wondering, I understand that you are still in the initial phase of the consultation period, but still, I'm just wondering whether you have already heard anything about what the FASB's focus should be the potential project in the future.
We received mixed views, I would say, similar to you on whether it should be a recognition and measurement project or disclosure only. Even mixed views about recognition and measurement. Some have said recognizing more intangible assets would add more cost to the system and wouldn't meet a cost benefit analysis, while others said more capitalization would really help, such as for research and development, it would really help make the balance sheet more reflective of a company's market cap. Some also suggested disclosures. As you said, some prefer disclosures. It ranges from additional quantitative or qualitative disclosures, such as more disclosures about research and development or intangible assets that are driving the company's market cap. We also received feedback specific to software and guidance about the software thresholds for capitalization. Also outside of the ITC, the FASB is also conducting a survey to obtain views from a broad and diverse population of financial statement users on intangibles. And that survey focuses on the information content currently provided about intangibles and how the information could be approved. So we also have that workflow to get additional information on that.
Thank you, Arika. And I think it would be particularly useful for us to learn from you as you get more evidence on that part. Because as Rika said, this seemed to be a recurring theme for almost every respondent to our consultation. So we want to learn as much as is possible on that one. Thank you. Zach, over to you.
Zach, you're mute.
Sorry, that did not work. It's got to happen once, right? So I was hoping to talk about something. I'm currently working through issues around when and how to weigh convergence into my thoughts on both agenda setting and technical decisions. And while I don't want to speak for my fellow board members, part of my personal calculus is that deviations from convergence at this point are likely to impose costs on multinational companies that report under both GAAP and US GAAP and IFRS standards, as well as on financial statement users who'll have to deal with disparate presentation of the same economics. So for a change such as the recent exposure document that you put out on accounting for revenue contracts in a business combination, which could replace the currently converged fair value accounting for business combinations, replacing that with contract accounting under the revenue standard. I was interested in hearing from the board members how you view the cost-benefit relationship, first when you added it to the agenda and now as you're deliberating that change at a more advanced state.
Okay, give Arika a pause. Rich.
Sure, maybe. Zach, I'll jump in and then let any of my fellow board members share their perspective if they'd like. I don't know that we have a formula for convergence versus divergence, right? And exactly how to weigh it. And I recognize it's something that we both deal with. For example, you're dealing with it in your rate regulated revenue standard that you're currently contemplating. From my perspective, I think it is part of the cost benefit analysis. The project you specifically mentioned, as I weighed that cost benefit analysis, I focused specifically on all the investor input we got about improving the relevance of information in that standard. We certainly recognize that that would increase costs for multinationals. Interestingly enough, most of those multinationals were very supportive of the change. So I think as they go through their own cost benefit analysis, that would have been an example of where they thought the benefits of the improved accounting outweighed the costs of possibly diverging. So I think it's a matter of judgment. I think it's something that we look at very carefully. I think each of our board members weigh that cost benefit equation. We would certainly prefer from a benefit side to be converged, but to the extent that we've seen an opportunity to improve financial reporting and it would result in some divergence, we will sometimes head that way. In that particular issue, I think some of us also weighed the fact that we kind of have this fair value construct with a plug called goodwill or negative goodwill that makes it all work. And some of us wonder whether that valuation of that in-process revenue arrangement was really the most appropriate to begin with. But let me let a few of my other board members weigh in. I know Gary and Marcia raised their hands to kind of provide you some input.
Okay, and we start with Gary.
You know, Zach, when I was thinking about, you know, your question here, you know, in terms of cost benefit, another way to think about it would be faithful representation versus relevance. You know, we've heard from a lot of investors that the current accounting really does not provide relevant information. In terms of the cost side of compares, you know, most companies are already providing non-GAAP information on the revenues that, quote, are either haircutted or disappear. So I think companies are already doing that. And to me, I think the focus should be on the relevance of the information after the acquisition, you know, not the technical details of the standard.
Clear, Marcia?
Yes, and I'll just add that as we work through this issue, I was definitely influenced by the comments we were receiving from our users, because there have been transactions. The existing GAAP model has been in place, and what we were hearing from the users is that it was not meeting their needs. So I agree with Gary, the fact that the information that the users were really trying to understand was being delivered through other vehicles in earnings releases or MD&A indicated that there could be room for improvement. And from my perspective, that felt like an improvement.
Thanks, Marcia. Sue Cospet.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what's already been said from my fellow board members. I do think it's something that we need to think about in terms of relevance and cost and benefit. You know, for those that are still around the table that worked, I'm looking at Sue Lloyd on many of the short-term convergence efforts and the more comprehensive convergence efforts. You know, I think that as we think about change, there's always a cost to change. And so I do think it's about, you know, there's so many factors that weigh into it, but I do think that we need to think about relevance. We need to think about operability and application and all of the things that we would think about that would affect the cost of whatever standard, you know, we might be considering.
Thank you, Sue. Jim, you want to come in on this?
Yeah, maybe just on this specific project, it actually got added to our agenda because we learned, I think it was actually one of the sweep issues that we got in fatal flaw review of our 606 standard, so the revenue standard, was, does the issuance of 606 change the accounting for deferred revenue in a business combination? That is, when I'm identifying obligations that I need to value in a business combination, do I use a legal liability construct? Do I use a 606 performance obligation construct, or do I use some other construct? For example, I identify obligations if they meet the definition of a liability pursuant to the framework. And what we heard is, in practice, all three of those views might be acceptable. We also understand from some firms that may be the case under IFRS. There are multiple views of, at least in practice, when an obligation is actually recognized in a business combination for revenue contracts. I don't know if your literature provides that, but we hear there are multiple views in, applied in practice. We knew there were multiple views applied in practice in the US. And so while the standards may have been converged in word, the actual performance of those standards identified that there was inconsistency even within US GAAP. So I think addressing that was really what first added this project to our agenda. It was then a secondary question about, okay, that being the case, do I measure obligations, you know, differently in a business combination than I do in a 606 construct? So maybe more specific to that issue, but it's certainly one of the things I weigh is, even if a standard is converged in word, do we get converged results in practice?
Thanks, Jim. So Zach, five board member reactions. Are you content with that answer? You still have your hand up. Want to come back in?
No, that's okay.
Okay, excellent. Let me go over to Anne, please.
Thanks, Andreas. My question is about digital financial reporting, so I'd be interested in comments from any of the FASB board or indeed staff. So it's more than 10 years now that the SEC has been requiring or permitting the digital tagging of financial statements. And my question is, if you could give us your comments on how this has affected the fact that investors are gathering information through digital means rather than a paper-based consumption of financial reports. So how's that impacted on your standard setting activities? Thank you.
Any takers? I may just
Christine is going to have a go.
Okay, Christine, go ahead.
Thanks. I'll take a first crack at it, and then if any of my colleagues want to weigh in. I would say that we have a very strong working relationship between the two sides of our house, the standard setting side and the XBRL side. And in response to feedback that we've received as that working relationship has evolved over that time period that you mentioned, Anne, we have received suggestions that we acted upon that that the XBRL analysis needed to be conducted in more real time with the standard setting process. And so the XBRL team is monitoring all of the major projects that we're working on where tagging may be a particularly important issue. And they're providing feedback to the teams so that we can consider any issues that might arise. Now, most of the time, I would say, at least in my experience of the 5 years that I've been a board member, it hasn't really been an issue in that we had to change a direction that we were following or making a decision that would be different than what we had planned because of concerns over XBRL tagging. It's more of working through those issues with the XBRL team so that if there are any issues, they can be resolved in real time. And I would say the other thing that I've noted as a board member is that we are also consumers of that XBRL data through our project activities. So we will often be going out and collecting XBRL data to get a lay of the land as we're starting a project to understand what information is currently being provided, or in PIR, you know, what the response has been to requirements. And I think that's increased our sensitivity to the types of issues that users might be experiencing. And so it certainly has increased my sensitivity to the need for that data to be accessible. And I think the XBRL team and the board and the staff are all learning in that process as well. So I guess my summary answer would be, it hasn't really changed what we do in terms of the decisions that we make as standard setters, but it has changed the interaction and the level of work between the XBRL side of the house and the standard setting side of the house.
Thank you, Christine. I know that Mary wishes to make a comment, but let's hear from Sue first, because you probably wanted to talk to that point as well.
Thanks, Andreas. Yeah, I just to add on just a couple of things. As XBRL has evolved over the years, and you know, certainly the information is used quite extensively by data aggregators. One of the areas of focus that the XBRL team has tried to do is develop some consistency in the application of tagging. And in some instances, in many instances actually, they issue implementation guides to help the preparers so that, you know, we don't have the multitude of extensions. And so, you know, ultimately, right, that the end user has better information because it's not as disparate. And so I would add on to that, that I think that, you know, some of the activities that have been undertaken over the years has actually improved the output of XBRL, which has actually made it more usable. And certainly for us, I think, as Christine pointed out, the research has been quite invaluable. And then I know in the external marketplace, there are certainly different software providers that have also picked up the XBRL information and, you know, enhanced search functions and whatnot, which I think has just been tremendous.
Thank you, Sue. Mary, please. Oh, sorry, I saw Hillary raising her hand as well, if that's okay, Mary.
Hillary, so I would say, yeah, just very quickly, you know, I think when we think of kind of consuming information in more digital format, I think that really coincides with the feedback that we're getting through the agenda consultation on further disaggregation of financial information. So I do think those things can go hand in hand. So I do think it does have a good connection back to the feedback that we're really looking to hear through the agenda consultation on disaggregation.
Thank you. Mary, now.
And Hillary's comment is actually a perfect setup for me. So thank you. Because when I think about, if Anne had addressed that question to me, okay, and there's, you know, reveal all, there's a great irony in me being the ISB member talking about digital, because I'm the Luddite who's still printing paper copies of our board papers to consume them that way. But I am trying to think about it from an impact on the decisions we make in standard setting, in other standard setting projects, because and it is kind of the type of thing that Hillary raised about disaggregation. And what I'm thinking about is, on the one hand, in our disclosure initiative and the ED we have out now, we are looking to focus more on objectives for disclosure, but trying to be aware of the tension that may raise with the primary consumption being, in the first instance, electronic. And if there's more variability in how people respond to disclosure requirements because of the focus on objectives, how will that impact tagging and therefore the ability to search for a term and find out what all the entities that are perhaps being screened have disclosed in response to, let's say, disclosure objectives about revenue. So thinking about the tensions of digital consumption when we are doing the standard setting in a particular subject matter is something that I think it's a challenge for us, especially for the Luddites in the crowd. So just an observation about personal experience. Thanks.
Thank you, Mary. And if you not had not made that comment, I would have made exactly the same comment, because it was striking to me that when Arika outlined the particular area of disaggregation of information, and you raised the question about, or Anne raised the question about digital, it seemed obvious to me that the two actually are going together. And I might just add from our perspective, and maybe Nili wants to talk to that end. We are having a very interesting discussion at the moment. It seems that digital is often equated with XBRL. And I think that might be a bit short-sighted, actually. XBRL is certainly part of digital, but is certainly not the end of digital. And we are investigating at this moment as to is digital still the quote-unquote only area that we should be dealing with, or do we have to open it up and look into how information is being consumed, how it is digested, how it is even be proliferated, and what does that mean in terms of how much we have to demand for the financial statements and the notes, and how much of that could actually be done through digital or other means. But that's just one part. Nili, if you want to come in on this, please feel free to.
Thanks, Andreas. I think you've expressed it well. What you probably observed in the agenda consultation is that we're asking for feedback about the priority of digital financial reporting. And within that, it's more than just the IFRS taxonomy, to Andreas's point. We sort of see three streams. There's the IFRS taxonomy, there's IFRS standards, and then there's sort of all of the other players that can help provide digital financial information to investors. And so as we're trying to get feedback through the agenda consultation, we're interested in all three aspects of what more can we as the ISB and staff do to improve the digital reporting for investors, given that it's not going away. This is the future. So we just have to figure out how to best support that future.
Thank you, Nili. And I know that Tom has been very patient. I ask for your patience for another 2 or 3 minutes because Christina wants to come back on this one. Christine, please.
Yeah, I'll be brief. I just wanted to respond to Mary's point because I thought it was such an excellent point. And I guess the way that I look at it is we often hear from investors that they want comparability and consistency. And when we write standards that provide comparability and consistency, then that does make the XBRL tagging easier. But at the same time, we have to balance that with sometimes the need for unique information, which then complicates XBRL tagging. And the way that I think about it is if there's a very good reason for there being less consistent or less comparable information, because it is going to reveal something important about the entity that will help users, then I'll bear the cost in my own calculus of the XBRL tagging potentially being more complicated. When it comes to objectives type disclosures specifically, I think that one of the things to think about in that realm is that providing objectives as opposed to specific disclosure requirements imposes quite a bit of cost on the system, even outside of the tagging issue. It imposes costs for auditors in determining whether the objectives have been met, preparers determining what the requirements or what disclosures would fulfill those objectives, for users in not getting comparable disclosures across companies, potentially even outside of the XBRL tagging issue. And so I think, you know, even without going to XBRL, there's a lot of issues in there to consider, which I know that you're all considering with respect to an objectives approach to disclosures.
Thank you for this, Christine. Finally, Tom.
Okay, I have a question. I want to go back to intangibles, and Rika asked about the focus of intangibles. And there are a lot of people out there concerned with intangibles, and they perceive the challenges differently. And often how we perceive a challenge or identify a challenge will say a lot about
how we might approach any solutions. I was interested in your opening sentence on page 19 of the invitation to comment, where you say stakeholders provided feedback that for many companies, there is a significant difference between book value and market capitalization for companies with significant tangible assets. And so my question is, to what degree is that difference in capitalization and book value an important part of the way you see the intangibles challenge?
Rich, please.
Sure. I think it's a great question, and we put that as an observation for a reason, and it's because, similar to the topic that we're going to cover at the end of this meeting, goodwill, there's lots of strong feelings on intangibles, but they're not all the same, right? This tends to be one of the criticisms we hear, which is, boy, there's an awful lot of value that's not on the balance sheet, and should it be on there? As we get deeper into that conversation, though, and say, okay, once we put it on there, what would you like to do with it? Where very often the troubles begin. And how would you like that day two accounting to go? So I think it's fair to say we heard of lots of different views on intangibles. It's not like we've heard a clear path. Hopefully we'll hear something out of the ITC where there's some relevant information that would make sense to pursue, but that's kind of why we worded it so broadly and so openly. But I will tell you, some stakeholders identify that as the issue that they are looking for some additional information on. It's that space between book value and market cap, and thinking that intangibles will somehow help close that gap.
Thank you, Rich. Gary, you wanted to talk to this point as well?
Yeah, following up on Tom's point about the thought about price to book, you know, so you can come at the intangibles point of view either on, you know, the book value or providing more informed decision useful information through disclosures, which Rika was hinting at. You know, if you look at the company that we're currently using their technology, they trade at a 25 times price to book value. My guess is nobody who's following Zoom even looks at the book value of the company. So if you think about when the FASB began back in 1973, the top five companies were GM, Ford, Chrysler, Exxon, and GE. Today it's Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Google. So the world back in 1973, as an analyst, you might've looked at the balance sheet, cash flow statement, income statement at the same level. Today, the focus is much more on revenue and cash is king, Nick Anderson's comment, and the balance sheet for non-financials has become less relevant. So you could, you know, go down the path of attempting to correct the problems with the price to book ratio, but analysts aren't looking at it for most companies. To me, it's more things are changing so quickly with innovation. How can we provide information on intangibles that a company is internally generating through disclosures that would give investors better information as part of what we do for providing decision useful information? That's how I think about it.
Thank you, Gary. Nick, do you want to come in on this point or do you have a separate issue?
No, if I could come on this point.
Absolutely, by all means.
Yeah. So, you know, face value, that's quite a provocative statement to users, I think. And I do hear those concerns about, you know, the gap between book value and market value, but I hear those from the world of accounting, not from the world of investing, I have to say. Intangibles are clearly important value drivers. One could argue the market's doing rather well. The gap reflects that in terms of being able to price those. Sure, we'd like more information, absolutely, and perhaps some more consistency in the treatment of intangibles. But I think closing that gap produces false relevance. So I'd be very wary in that respect.
Clear statement, Christine.
Yeah, so just following up from what Gary and Nick just said, which I agree with wholeheartedly, I think that it does highlight the importance of disaggregation, though, on the income statement and greater disaggregation to help investors to conduct their own valuations of the entity.
and provide that information either through disclosures on the face of the income statement, in the cash flow statement, because the balance sheet is relatively less important, I would argue, with these entities that have a lot of their value tied up in intangibles.
Thanks, Christine. Over to you, Sue.
So I have a new question. So if there's anybody else that wants to weigh in on this one.
I suspect that Bertrand wants to come in on intangibles.
Okay.
Yeah, just to comment on this one, effectively, I would tend to agree with Nick on the fact that I would be cautious to incorporate more intangibles in the balance sheet. And probably that's because if you think of intellectual property licenses, even there were a lot of evolution between the sale or the acquisition of right to use licenses to right to access licenses. And those right to access licenses, if I refer to a recent agenda decision by the Integrations Committee on SaaS arrangements, they were considered as service arrangements. So the real question is, notably for intellectual property licensing, whether you control or not the intellectual property itself. Then in this case, I would tend to, it's a very personal view, but I would tend to think that effectively it's an intangible asset. Otherwise, you could question whether it's just a service you've sold or acquired. And then effectively, there won't be any incorporation of intangible assets within the balance sheet. So I'm pretty aligned with Nick on this one.
Thank you, Bertrand. Gary, is that a new hand?
Oh, sorry.
Okay, all good. Sue.
Yes, I just have a question. In your request for information, the first question, you talk about your strategic direction. And I really wanted to just focus in on the point about developing and maintaining the IFRS for SMEs. And I know that there's been, quite a lot of work that's gone on in the last few months at least on the 2020 proposal to update the SME, IFRS for SMEs. And I guess I just wondered whether or if this agenda document would cause any delay to that. And the reason I'm asking is because I know that in that proposal, right, they're considering some of the more comprehensive standards. So I just wanted to ask that question while we had everybody here.
Eli, you want to come in on this?
Yeah, or Rafal, did you want to answer or do you want me to jump in?
Go ahead, Nidhi, please.
Okay, thanks. It's a great question, Sue. In terms of the timing of the work on the IFRS for SMEs update, I don't really see that as being affected by the agenda consultation. Part of our starting point with the agenda consultation is that what's already on the board's agenda would continue as planned. So anything that comes out of the agenda consultation would just be added as and when the board has time, unless there's something urgent that we would need to do in a more time-sensitive manner. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it absolutely answers my question. I just, considering that this phase of the IFRS for SMEs, consider some of like RevRec and some of the others, I thought it was good to know whether that would commence as planned. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions or comments? This is your time on the agenda consultation. Doesn't seem to be the case. Well, then I could wrap it up by firstly thanking our staff for providing us with an update. I think it's useful to know and to get probably the slightly different emphasis on the documents. But what I would really like to say is, given that both of our consultations end towards the end of September, I think that would really facilitate a prime opportunity for both boards to actually inform each other of the feedback that we have heard. You have quite a few items that also feature in our document. Obviously, the SME standard will be one that doesn't feature on your side. But conversely, you may have other issues that your stakeholders have actually opined on, and we certainly want to hear this feedback as well. as we devise our strategy going forward. So I think I would really hope that our two boards could knock their heads together. The staff will do anyway. If we do have another opportunity for discussing that before the year end, I would suppose. And I would suggest, Rich, that the two of us get together on this and just see how we can progress in Q4 in some way, and potentially scheduling another education session and peeking ahead a little bit of any other business. But this seems to be a prime opportunity to me to really touch base again before the end of the year.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, sorry, Rich.
And Andreas, I think the timing wasn't a coincidence. So I think that sounds like a great plan.
Excellent. Okay. On that happy note, I'm aware that we are a few minutes ahead, but nonetheless, I suggest that we do take a break and that we reconvene at 5 past the hour and go to our favorite topic. Thanks a lot.